Thank you for being here today to help us honor the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King and to explore one of the most critical issues today. Dr. King was convinced that nonviolent resistance is the most potent weapon available to those struggling for a just cause. Some 40 years ago, he said, "Nonviolence means avoiding not only external physical violence, but also internal violence of spirit. Not only must you refuse to shoot a man, but you must also refuse to hate him." I think we all know that that's hard to do. Yesterday, hundreds of thousands of people gathered in Washington, D.C. and in San Francisco, many of them striving to emulate the model of nonviolence embodied by Dr. King and by Mahatma Gandhi before him. Several hundred citizens who participated in those marches yesterday boarded buses right here in Claremont. I'm pleased today to introduce to you a man who is no stranger to the practice of nonviolent action for positive change. He has written and spoken widely on issues of human rights and social justice. He was, in fact, a colleague of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and is life director of the King Center, having served as chair during its initial year in 1968. Since 1981, he has served as a leader of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and has dozens of other important posts to his credit. He's an esteemed member of the Claremont community, having served for 28 years as a university president, 17 of which were at the Claremont Graduate University, where he is now senior fellow in the Institute for Democratic Renewal. Please join me in welcoming Dr. John McGuire.
Thank you, Leslie, and your colleagues to whom we're all so grateful for arranging today. And thank you for the honor that you've given me to introduce today's speaker. As Chief Weapons Inspector for the United Nations Special Commission in Iraq, our speaker was labeled a hero by some, a maverick by others, and a spy by Iraq. In charge of searching out weapons of mass destruction within Iraq, Scott Ritter was on the front lines of the ongoing battle against arms proliferation. His experience and his post served as the basis for his book, Endgame, which explores the shortcomings of American foreign policy in the Persian Gulf region and alternative approaches to handling the Iraqi crisis. Scott Ritter and I share a boyhood connection, Florida. He was born there, I was raised there. He was raised all over the world in a career military family. He's a graduate of Franklin and Marshall College with a BA in Soviet history. Before his involvement in Iraq, he had an extensive and distinguished career in government service. He's a ballistic missile technology expert who worked with military intelligence during a 12-year career in the United States Armed Forces, including assignments in the former Soviet Union and the Middle East. A former major in the United States Marines, he also spent several months of the Gulf War serving under General Norman Schwarzkopf with Marine Central Command Headquarters in Saudi Arabia. In 1991, Scott Ritter joined the United Nations Weapons Inspection Team, known as UNSCOM. He took part in 52 inspection missions, 14 of them as the chief weapons inspector. In 1995, his team discovered missile guidance equipment that Iraq had bought from Russia through a Palestinian agent. He led the UN Weapons Inspection Team into Iraq in January of 1998, but was blocked from the weapons sites by Iraqi officials who claimed that Mr. Ritter and his team were spying. He later resigned his positions for reasons I think he'll touch upon today. Scott Ritter returned to Iraq in the year 2000 to film a documentary called In Shifting Sands, The Truth of UNSCOM and the Disarming of Iraq, which focuses on the disarmament of Iraq and its implications for U.S. foreign policy. Our hope today is that Scott Ritter's own experience and insight will serve to enlighten us about one of today's most critical and controversial issues, which appears to be the growingly imminent war with Iraq. What, from his perspective, would be the effects of such a war? Are there alternatives to this war? That's what you came to hear. It's a distinctive pleasure and an enormous privilege to introduce Scott Ritter to you today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the extremely kind words of introduction. Certainly is an honor and a privilege to be here today to have a chance to interact with the people of Claremont in Southern California. Might seem to be odd that you have somebody such as me up before you. After all, I can guarantee you that I am not a pacifist. Having spent 12 years in the Marine Corps in service of my country, I guarantee you that not only have I gone to war for my country, but I would go to war again at a drop of a hat if I felt that there was something out there threatening the country which I love and I cherish. So I think it's great that we have someone such as myself here with people who espouse a differing belief, a differing standing, and we're all united in a single cause, which is avoiding war with Iraq. I think we can agree that a war with Iraq, no matter what the justification, is going to have horrific consequences. Now, I want to frame this. I want to frame this discussion that we're going to have, and I'll start off by saying that I'm not here today to deliver a monologue or a soliloquy or to berate you. I'm here today to participate in the process of American democracy. Okay, and that's what I believe in more than anything else. When I was a Marine Corps officer, I took an oath to uphold and defend the United States Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I believe in the Constitution. I believe in American democracies. I believe in the rule of law. And, you know, a democracy cannot function unless we, the people of the United States of America, are involved. And it can't function properly unless we who get involved are empowered with knowledge and information so that we can make an informed decision about these issues which confront us. So today, to me, represents one of the best aspects of American democracy. Concerned citizens gathering together, united out of a need and a desire for information about what I feel is one of the most critical periods in our nation's history, at least in modern times. The impending war with Iraq. Where do we go? What do we do? Why will we be fighting? These are questions that must be answered. They must be answered. And answered to you, the people of the United States, because I firmly believe that when we speak of government of the people, by the people, for the people, that's exactly it. We, the people of the United States of America, are the government. We must hold those whom we elected to represent us in higher office accountable for what they do in our name, and we cannot begin to hold them accountable until we ourselves are educated about the facts. So I'm going to talk for a little while. I'm going to throw out some facts, some figures, and I'm going to challenge you. I hope I challenge you. And then I'm going to do what is absolutely required in a democracy, hold myself accountable for what I've said and take questions so that we can begin the process of dialogue, discussion, and debate, and not just limit it to the confines of this wonderful church, but to take it with us when we leave this building so that we can empower the entire community to start debating the issue of war with Iraq. The first way I want to frame this is that concept of war itself. Let's remember what we're talking about here. This is not an academic discussion, war. You know, fortunately, we've grown up in a world where Americans don't know war, especially, you know, children, people who are going to college. But I should remind everybody in the audience that the average age of the Marine Corps Lance Corporal that will lead this battle into Iraq is 20 years old. 20 years old. And when we talk about going to war, it is not a Nintendo game. When you get hit, your life force runs out. You don't get to hit reset and come back to life. It doesn't work that way. War is about death and destruction, about killing human beings. When I was a Marine Corps officer, I took my Marines to the rifle range a couple times a year to practice shooting the paper targets from 200, 300, 500 yards away. Not because the United States government had a grudge against national paper. It's because I was training my Marines to take 5.56 millimeters of copper jacketed steel and put it into the body of a human being, terminating life. That's what war is about. Never forget it. When I was a Marine Corps officer, I would stand on a hill with a radio calling in artillery strikes on stacks of tires, not because we had a problem with Goodyear or Goodrich, but because I was preparing to take 155 millimeters of steel-encased high explosive and put it on a target, terminating human life. That is what war is about, killing. And I have to tell you right now, as a Marine Corps officer, former Marine, my Marines were the finest killing machine the world's ever seen. If we needed to be unleashed on a target, I guarantee you this, we would prevail, and we will prevail. We will kill everything that's in front of us. And I'm not ashamed of that, because when I took command of Marines and I got prepared to lead them off the war, my obligation is to those Marines, to my country, to prevail. I need to bring my Marines home alive, intact, which means anything and everything that opposes me, that confronts me, will be terminated. We are indeed the dogs of war. We are the hellhounds, and when you unleash us, hell will follow. So, America, I implore you, do not unleash the American military unless there is just cause, unless there is a reason. We need to honor and respect those who wear the uniform of the United States of America, not because we support war or endorse war, but because we support the Constitution of the United States of America and understand that this nation, the United States of America, stands for something. We stand for the rule of law. We stand for individual civil liberties, the kind of civil liberties that Dr. Martin Luther King fought and struggled so hard to preserve. We stand for an ideal, for a vision of a free nation, of democracy, of life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. This is the nation that our founding fathers had a vision of when they framed the Constitution 220 some odd years ago. We fought a war to liberate ourselves from an imperial power, and we said that we, the people of the United States of America, will be a different kind of country, a country worth fighting for. You know, Abraham Lincoln had it right when he spoke his Gettysburg Address on the horrible field of battle back in 1863, when he was out there speaking about the sacrifice that tens of thousands of Americans made. So why? What could justify this? Why do democracies such as ours go to war? What justifies this horror? He said, so the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the face of the earth. Ladies and gentlemen, I put on the uniform of the United States Marine to defend my country. I would die for every one of you today. I was prepared to die for you when I was a Marine. And there are today hundreds of thousands of brave young Americans who wear our uniform. And I say our uniform because it is an American uniform. These are a national treasure that we must cherish. They wear our uniform and they are prepared to die for you right now, to give up their life in defense of America, in defense of you. Don't we therefore have an obligation to ensure that before we ask them to make such a sacrifice, that it is in a cause worthy of such a sacrifice? That when we speak of going to war, that war must be in defense of the democracy, defense of the republic. And right now, when we speak of Iraq, no such case has been made. And therefore, I am concerned that when we speak of war with Iraq, we are speaking about a war that is inherently un-American in its nature. A war that, rather than defending the Constitution of the United States, is a direct affront to the Constitution of the United States, and we as Americans have every duty and responsibility to oppose it. Now, I've been much maligned. I've been criticized for speaking out against this war and against the Bush policies. I've been called unpatriotic. I've been called treasonous. And I'm not against being criticized, I think it's only fair. If I'm going to criticize, people have every right to criticize me. That's part of a fair and free discussion. But I tell you what, when the people who criticize represent the government of the United States, represent elected officials, that's where I have a problem. You see, it's un-American not to speak out. It's un-American not to question. It is our duty and responsibility as freedom-loving American citizens to ensure that those whom we elect to higher office truly represent what we feel. We have every right to speak out. You know, we do it on a local basis every day of the year. Where I come from in New York, we had a big controversy about dredging of the Hudson River, whether or not General Electric dropped PCBs in the river and they were producing pollution that threatened, you know, the children and the people and the livelihood of that region. Do we dredge? Do we not dredge? And we had town hall meetings. It was wonderful to watch democracy in action. A town hall meeting. American citizens came together and they debated, they discussed, they had a dialogue, a discourse. They held their elected representatives accountable for their position. If you were in favor of dredging, tell me why and explain why. Provide me facts and figures, and woe be it to the politician that couldn't justify his or her position. That is democracy, holding those whom we elect responsible. And it works at a local level. At the end of the debate, no one there stood up and pointed a finger to those who opposed them and said, you're a treasonous, you're a traitor, you're unpatriotic for speaking out. Absolutely not. Well, if it works at the local level, ladies and gentlemen, it should work at the highest level possible, especially when we're talking about the consequences of policies being war. It is un-American not to question the policy of the United States when it comes to war. It is un-American not to speak out. The most patriotic thing you can do at this point in time in our nation's history is to assert your constitutional rights as an American citizen to say, Mr. President, while we elected you president, and some people will say we didn't, but we regardless of where you stand on that issue, Mr. President, let's remember at the end of the day, you are not the government. I am the government. We are the government. We, the people of the United States of America. And so now we talk Iraq. Does Iraq pose a threat to the security of the United States of America that warrants our nation, our republic, going to war? Well, let's talk about weapons of mass destruction. Iraq had them. For that, there is no debate. Iraq had massive programs dedicated to the manufacture of chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, and long-range ballistic missiles. I'm not here today to defend in any way whatsoever Saddam Hussein or his horrific regime. I know more about that regime than just about any American today. And I'm here to tell you, it's as bad as you have heard, sometimes even worse. He's a brutal, despotic dictator who has inflicted horrific crimes against his people and the people of the region. But again, with all due respect to the people of Iraq, I'm not here beseeching on their behalf. I'm here beseeching on behalf of the Americans who wear the uniform of the United States of America, who will be called upon to give their life. While my heart goes out to the people of Iraq, the situation inside Iraq is not worthy of one American life unless that situation threatens our republic. That's my personal belief. And Saddam Hussein, as bad as he is, must be shown to represent a threat to American democracy, the American way of life, the United States of America, before I'll support going to war. So I do not believe that Saddam Hussein, the nature of his regime in and of itself, constitutes a cause worthy of war. It constitutes a cause worthy of concern. We should be very concerned about what's happening inside Iraq today. We should be very concerned about the human rights situation. We should be very concerned about how Saddam Hussein oppresses his people, how people cannot live a democratic life, how they cannot aspire to maybe the standards that we ourselves aspire to. We should be concerned about that, and we should be doing what we can to better the situation. But you know, one of the best ways to better the situation is through engagement, diplomatic and otherwise. And unfortunately, for the past decade, we have not engaged with Iraq. We have isolated Iraq. We have built a gap between the people of the United States and the people of Iraq. So we're not in a position right now to have any effect on the internal domestic situation in Iraq other than through military intervention. And again, I don't feel military intervention is ever justified unless there's a threat out there that warrants it. Does Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs warrant such a threat? The international community felt so back in 1991, following the Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in August 1990 and Operation Desert Storm, the Gulf War, which was mandated by the Council to achieve the liberation of Kuwait. Even after the liberation of Kuwait, the international community said that Iraq's programs are a threat to international peace and security. Their weapons of mass destruction programs, that their chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, and long-range ballistic missiles in and of themselves represent a threat, and they must be done away with. The only way that Iraq can be brought back into the fold of the law-abiding international community, said the Security Council, is through disarmament, getting rid of these weapons of mass destruction. And they mandated a group of weapons inspectors to go into Iraq and oversee this disarmament. That, ladies and gentlemen, is international law. Whether you agree with it or not, that's the law. And again, I have to remind you, as an American who has took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States, understand this. Article 6 of the Constitution clearly states that when we, the people of the United States of America, enter into an international agreement or treaty that has been ratified by two-thirds of the United States Senate, that is the law of the land here in America. We are signatories to the United Nations Charter. We are members of the Security Council of the United Nations. So when the Security Council, to whom we are a member of, passes a resolution under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter, which authorizes military force to accomplish a given goal or objective, in this case, Resolution 687, which calls for Iraq's disarmament, we are obligated to uphold and defend that resolution. The Security Council, led by the United States, resolved that Iraq cannot have weapons of mass destruction. They resolved that weapons inspectors will go into Iraq and oversee the disarmament of Iraq. They demanded from Iraq full cooperation, zero obstruction, and they set the level of compliance at 100%. Iraq must be fully disarmed before a finding of compliance can be had. But you know that international law said one other thing, that if Iraq is found to be in compliance, economic sanctions which were imposed on Iraq in August of 1990 when they invaded Kuwait, economic sanctions which at that time were linked to Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait, but following the liberation of Kuwait, relinked to Iraq's obligation to disarm, these economic sanctions would be lifted. That, ladies and gentlemen, is international law. Let's talk about weapons inspections and how they're going to work and how international law is going to work. For weapons inspections to succeed in Iraq, you must have Iraq's total cooperation. Weapons inspections simply cannot succeed if Iraq obstructs, if Iraq lies, if Iraq conceals, if Iraq obfuscates, if Iraq doesn't give 100% cooperation. For weapons inspections to succeed in Iraq, and remember, the weapons inspections are mandated by international law, the Security Council must be willing to enforce its law if faced with Iraqi obstruction, if faced with Iraqi noncompliance. I mean, what good is a law if you're not willing to enforce it? If you have a speed limit out here in town of 35 miles an hour and you have a cop out there with a radar gun and people are zipping by at 75 miles an hour and the cop doesn't do anything, what good is the law? Enforce the law. So if you're going to say Iraq must be disarmed and Iraq chooses not to disarm, chooses to interfere, you've got to be prepared to enforce the law. In the case of Iraq, enforcement means something that impacts dramatically on the Iraqi leadership. Because when we speak of Iraq, understand this. The only opinion that matters in Iraq at this point in time is the opinion of Saddam Hussein. So if you're talking about enforcement, you're talking about putting pressure on Iraq, which compels Saddam Hussein to change his mind. That means you don't go through, you get to him through the people of Iraq. You don't get to him through the economy of Iraq. To get to Saddam Hussein, you have to go to Saddam Hussein. So enforcement means the kind of dramatic military intervention that threatens the continued existence of Saddam Hussein. This is a harsh reality if we're speaking of enforcement of laws. But there's another aspect to this too. It's not just about holding Iraq accountable to the rule of international law, but it's ensuring that those who implement international law are likewise held accountable to international law, meaning the weapons inspectors and the Security Council itself. See, the Security Council mandated the disarmament of Iraq, and I think that's a good thing. Iraq should be disarmed. The nature of Saddam Hussein's regime has shown that he is irresponsible when it comes to weapons of mass destruction. He's used them against his own people, he's used it against his neighbors, and he's used them as a means of leveraging Iraq's military strength into some sort of regional hegemony. This cannot stand. But it doesn't talk about getting rid of Saddam Hussein. If you'll take a close look at Security Council resolutions, you will not find a single resolution that speaks of regime removal. In fact, read the United Nations Charter, and you'll see the United Nations Charter specifically prohibits regime removal. It says that no nation or group or nation has the rights to go in and pick and choose the leadership of a sovereign state. That is the sole prerogative of the people of that nation. And again, I remind you, because our Constitution says that when we sign the United Nations Charter, we must abide by that charter, that when the President of the United States says that his policy in regards to Iraq is regime removal, it's an illegal policy. It's a policy that's not only a violation of international law, but ladies and gentlemen, it's a policy which is a violation of the Constitution of the United States of America. But I need to point out that our current president is not the only one guilty of making this this policy and implementing this policy. In fact, policy of regime removal has been in place and in practice since 1991, dating back to the presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st president. You know, as a weapons inspector, and my fellow weapons inspectors and I were confronted with the fact that while we were there to implement international law and to oversee the disarm of Iraq, we had to deal not only with Iraqi obstruction and noncompliance, but also the fact that the United States had stated right from the beginning that even if Iraq fully cooperates with the weapons inspectors, even if the inspectors can find that Iraq has been disarmed, economic sanctions will not be lifted until which time Saddam Hussein is removed from power. So the United States said from the very beginning, we're not going to play the game. What we want is regime removal. What we want is Saddam Hussein finished. And that is not reflective of international law. That is not reflective of what the mission of the weapons inspectors were. So here's the crunch. Implementing the law. So long as the United States of America maintains a policy of regime removal that takes priority over internationally mandated disarmament, the weapons inspection process is inherently corrupted. Inherently corrupted. In the same way that we would be against a police department that's implementing the law, but what happens if this police department goes after a suspected drug dealer and plants evidence? Slides that 30-gram pack of cocaine under the bed as they do a raid on the house, and then take the drug dealer off. Now, maybe that drug dealer is a drug dealer. Maybe he has a past of doing bad things. But when the cop plants evidence, when the cop does an illegal search and seizure, when the cop does an illegal wiretap, the cop has corrupted due process of law. The cop themselves have become a violator of the law. Therefore, what happens to the suspect? The suspect walks. Not because the suspect's innocent, but because the system has failed. And we talk about Iraq. We talk about enforcing and implementing international law. It's not so much, it's not only that we have to hold Iraq accountable to the rule of law, but we have to hold those who implement the rule of law likewise accountable, meaning that when weapons inspectors go into Iraq, their job is to disarm Iraq, not to facilitate the collection of intelligence information to terminate Saddam Hussein's existence. So now we speak of Iraq, their obligation to cooperate. I have to tell you that on this, Iraq has a very poor track record. From the very beginning, from 1991, Iraq chose to lie, to distort the truth, to conceal, to deceive. Iraq was obligated in April of 1991 to submit a full declaration of its holdings of weapons of mass destruction, listing the totality of everything it had in chemical, biological, nuclear, and long-range ballistic missile capability. And Iraq chose, instead of telling the truth, they chose to lie. They submitted an incomplete declaration, one that declared around 50% of their chemical weapons capability, around 50% of their ballistic missile capability, one which denied altogether having any biological weapons or denied having any nuclear weapons program. Now, weapons inspectors, I have to tell you, to be a good weapons inspector, Remember what we're going after, chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles. So if you're going to go after chemical weapons, you're going to want a chemist. If you're going to go after biological weapons, you want a biologist. If you want to go after nuclear weapons, you want a nuclear physicist. And yes, there is a role in this world for rocket scientists. If you want to go after ballistic missiles, you need a rocket scientist. You need people who are technically qualified to do the job. And that's what we staffed ourselves with in the early days of UNSCOM, of the weapons inspection process. People who were technically qualified to do the job. Because the job, as set forth by the Security Council, was a basic accounting job. Iraq declares, the inspectors verify. The inspection process, view it like an engine. You've got this giant engine, the inspection process. Information is the fuel which drives the inspection process. You need information to inspect. Where are you going to go? What are you going to do when you go into Iraq? You need information. In accordance with the law, Iraq was obligated to provide this information, and they chose not to. So now the inspector's in a problem. What do you do? Well, one of the things that happened is we had to turn to other nations for help. When we realized Iraq was not telling the truth, we had to turn to other nations. And this ended up being a very good move. In fact, we turned to the United States and said, can you help us? And in June 1991, the United States provided intelligence information that said there is a facility in western Baghdad, in western suburbs of western Baghdad, where there are 100 trucks with material on the back we believe are related to prohibited activity. So the inspectors went to this facility and surrounded it. In accordance with the rules, they knock on the door, the doors are supposed to open, they go in and they inspect. They show up the facility, sort of peer over the wall, and there are the trucks. They go, good, we're going to get to do our job. Knocked on the door, and the Iraqi said, you can't come in. And the inspectors, well, what do you mean we can't come in? We're here, we're mandated, the law says you must open the door, please open the door. Well, the Iraqis who said you can't come in had little black berets and automatic weapons. The inspectors had blue hats and no weapons. Guess who won that standoff? The inspectors didn't go in. The inspectors called back to the United Nations and said, we're here at the site. The United Nations headquarters said, great, are you in? They said, no, they won't let us in. And the diplomats of the United Nations went, what do you mean they won't let us in? The law says they have to. You're there, they must let you in. They're not. What do we do? The diplomats scratched their head and said, well, go back to your hotel, we're going to confer. So the inspectors went back to the hotel, and the diplomats conferred. They pick up the phone, they called the Iraqi leadership and said, what are you doing? You got to let them in. The Iraqis went, yeah, you're right, we made a mistake. It was a miscommunication, there was a problem, the guy at the site wasn't sure what was going on. Send your inspectors out there tomorrow, everything will be okay. So, next day comes, the inspectors go out to the site, they surround the facility, the door opens, but there's no trucks. And site's empty. Inspectors go in, go, where are the trucks? And the Iraqis go, what trucks? And they go, the ones that were here yesterday. There were no trucks yesterday, the one that made those tire prints. Oh, those are old. The Iraqis said, look, it was hot yesterday, really hot. You guys were hallucinating, seeing things. And this is true. This is what the Iraqis said. You must have been seeing things. So the inspectors called back to New York and said, we're at the site. Did they open the door? Yes. What'd you find? Nothing. What do you mean nothing? The trucks are gone. Well, where'd they go? The Iraqis said they were never there. What do you mean? We have photographs to prove it. Doesn't matter. So the inspectors were sent back to the hotel while the diplomats conferred. A couple days later, the United States provided another photograph that showed that the trucks had been moved 60 kilometers further west. The inspectors this time went, but they weren't going to take no for an answer. They surrounded the site. They sent inspectors up a tower who verified the trucks were there. As he pulled out his camera to take pictures, the Iraqis took fire shots at him, forcing them down. But his presence on the tower made the Iraqis panic. And they opened up the back doors, and off the Iraqis went, pouring their vehicles out the back. The inspectors climbed in their jeeps and went after them, driving alongside, taking close-up photographs of the material on the back of the trucks until the Iraqis pointed a machine gun, fired a couple bursts, terminating that effort. But it was too late for the Iraqis. The inspectors had the proof they needed that Iraq had lied in their declaration, that Iraq had a nuclear weapons program, because what was on the back of those trucks were the components used by Iraq to enrich uranium for a nuclear bomb. The inspectors did their job. What did the international community do? Remember, for inspections to work, Iraq has to fully cooperate. Iraq was not fully cooperating. For inspections to work, you got to enforce your law. And here we have an example of Iraq going out of its way not to abide by the rule of law. What did the Security Council do? They consulted and they said, we're going to pass another resolution. We're going to resolve to be resolute. We're going to tell the Iraqis that this is unacceptable. You cannot behave in this fashion. That we really, really, really are serious about disarmament. That we're going to send the inspectors back in and you have to cooperate. You have to do everything possible. You have to tell us the truth. Stop lying. Submit a declaration that lists the totality of your holdings. And that was it. Now, I have to tell you, as a weapons inspector, this is unsatisfactory. Because we don't have the means to compel Iraq to cooperate. Our job is to implement the law, and when Iraq chooses not to abide by the law and we don't get backed up by the Security Council, imagine what position that puts us in. To go into Iraq, to be hard-nosed and aggressive. And the other thing is, the Iraqis just changed the whole nature of the game. You see, before that, we were taking Iraqi information and acting on it. It was Iraqi information that was driving the inspection engine. But now they changed the nature of the game. You see, they're liars. They're concealers. They're obstructors. And for us to do our job now, we need additional sources of information. And that information comes from member states, such as the United States, that just provided very good information helping us overcome this one obstacle. But what happens when you become addicted to a source of information, such as American intelligence? Who's now driving the inspection machine? The inspectors? No, it's the United States. Because their information is required to get the inspectors where they want. The United States gets to pick the place and the timing of inspections. Now, if the United States policy was supporting regime removal, if the United States policy was supporting disarmament, this would be a good thing. But the United States has a policy of regime removal, getting rid of Saddam Hussein. One of the things that prevents the United States from getting rid of Saddam Hussein is incomplete intelligence about his security, where he's located. Now you have inspectors that are uniquely positioned to gain access to the most sensitive sites inside Iraq. How do you use them? You give them intelligence. You send them to places in Iraq and you learn about Saddam Hussein, not about his weapons of mass destruction. You know, the United States wasn't apologetic about this. They said, our job is to get rid of Saddam Hussein. That's our policy. We're going to get rid of him. But as a weapons inspector, this is unacceptable. A weapons inspector has to be there to implement the law in accordance with the mandate of the council. So we had to change the way we did business. You know, if you took a look at photographs of the early inspection teams, all these distinguished chemists, biologists, nuclear physicists, and rocket scientists, they're all gentlemen in their 40s and 50s, and I'm in my 40s, so I can't complain or point fingers to anymore, but their necks tended to begin here and end right about here, the little toothpick arms, because their job was science. If you take a look at the photographs of inspection teams afterwards, you got these young strapping men whose necks begin here and end here, and they got arms that come out here, because the nature of the inspection team changed. We became a very aggressive group of inspectors whose job was to go into Iraq and gain access to the information we needed to do our job. You see, Iraq's not allowed to have weapons of mass destruction. Iraq's not allowed to have, you know, the components or information pertaining to weapons of mass destruction. And if Iraq chooses to fail to cooperate, the inspectors have to go on and get it. That's their job. So they have to bring in people like me. I'm not a rocket scientist. I'm not a chemist. I'm not a biologist. I'm an intelligence officer. I'm a spy. That's what I did for a living. I usually did it in service of my country, but now my country said you have to go help the United Nations. But spying on Iraq, and from the context of the United Nations, meant facilitating the mandate of disarmament. You see, if Iraq has information pertaining to weapons of mass destruction, my job was to get it and to use whatever means necessary to do so. Iraq's not allowed to have these weapons. So spy is a little incorrect to talk about what I was doing in Iraq. Spy is short for espionage. Espionage stands, you know, for gaining information that you have no right to. You know, when I was a weapons inspector in the former Soviet Union, if I was tasked, and I'm not saying I was, but if I was tasked by my country to climb over the fence of a missile factory, go inside a building and take pictures of Soviet missiles, and I got caught, I get arrested. I go to jail. I get charged with espionage. Why? Because I'm breaking Soviet law. I'm not allowed to be in that factory. I'm not allowed to be in that building taking those pictures. But in Iraq, if Iraq is hiding weapons of mass destruction, and they're not freely giving it over, as a weapons inspector, I am not only mandated, but obligated to use whatever means necessary to gain access to that information. This means that we would use high-altitude photographic airplanes, the U-2 airplane. People call it a spy airplane. It's not a spy airplane when it's flying over Iraq, so long as its task is to take pictures that facilitate disarmament. I led teams of inspectors into Iraq who listened to the most sensitive communications of Saddam Hussein and his inner circle, not because we were spying on them, but because we were trying to find out if they were moving things. We recruited people inside Iraq to report to us on potential of hiding weapons of mass destruction. This is what we did. And so long as this was focused on the work of disarmament, we were not spies. The Iraqis spent a lot of time calling us spies, though, saying that we were there, you know, to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Well, we weren't there, but the United States had a policy of regime removal that polluted our work, that corrupted our integrity. And that is the problem. It's not just the corruption of the integrity, though, that we're talking about. There's another issue, too. I'm going to talk about economic sanctions for a while. I'm a weapons inspector. I'm not a humanitarian worker, but I want to put this in the proper context for you. Remember when I said war isn't academic? Well, neither are sanctions. When you hear the term economic sanctions, a lot of people say, well, you know, that's just that economic embargo thing we got going on in Iraq. And they brought it on themselves. They're not cooperating. Well, remember, economic sanctions, this is part of a, you know, is involved in the quid pro quo deal. Iraq cooperates, sanctions will be lifted. Why did we put sanctions on Iraq to begin with? To compel the Iraqi government to give up the weapons that we said they're not allowed to have. But from the very beginning, the United States made it clear that no matter what happens, even if Iraq fully cooperates, the sanctions will not be lifted. So, ladies and gentlemen, for those who say it's Saddam Hussein's fault that the Iraqi people suffer under economic sanctions, that Saddam Hussein has the key that can open the door to let the situation improve in Iraq, I say no, it's the United States that shut the door, locked the door, and threw away the key. The only way sanctions are going to be lifted is if Saddam Hussein is gone. And that is a violation of international law. Just keep that in mind. And when we talk about sanctions, it's not just this, again, this academic argument of violation of international law. Let's put a human face on it. Economic sanctions means that Iraq cannot function as a modern nation state. It's a total economic embargo. And we're talking about a nation that was subjected to one of the most horrific aerial bombardments in modern times. A nation that, you know, imagine what would happen in Claremont or L.A. if you eliminated their maintenance budget. Just you're not going to have a maintenance budget. When your roads go bad, you can't repair them. When your buildings go bad, they don't repair. They collapse. What would this city look like? What would this community look like in 1 year? Pretty bad. Imagine 10 years. Even worse. 10 years of no maintenance. Then on top of that, bomb them every once in a while. First of all, bomb them and remove their water purification plants, to damage their power generation plants, and then say, you can't rebuild. You can't rebuild. That's what's happened in Iraq. And what is the end result? You know, we say sanctions, we want to compel Saddam to cooperate. How do you compel him? You compel him by putting pressure on the Iraqi people. But what does this word pressure mean? It means people die. And it's not just 1, 2, 5, or 10. They die by the thousands. During the period of maximum effectiveness of the sanctions in terms of direct impact on the economic well-being of Iraq, from 1992 to 1996, Iraqis were dying at a rate of 5,000 to 6,000 a month, most of whom were children under the age of 5, preschool kids, children under the age of 5. Imagine being a mother and having your child get sick and going to a doctor and you can't get treatment. Imagine how it would feel taking that child home and having to hold that child for days, weeks, while a child melted away. Are we teaching that mother to love? I don't think so. And ladies and gentlemen, economic sanctions have killed anywhere from 350,000 to 1.5 million Iraqis. That's a lot of Iraqis. That's a lot of pressure. That's a lot of dead people. And again, people say, well, it's Saddam Hussein's fault. No, I have a different outlook on it. You see, I blame Saddam Hussein. He has a great deal of responsibility. But if I hop in a car with anybody here and we go driving through downtown Claremont, and I say, hey, stop the car outside a bank. I jump out, and I go into the bank, and I pull out a pistol, and I say, this is a robbery. Put up your hand. Boom, I kill the guard. Boom, I kill somebody else. I grab the money, get in the car, and drive off. Who's the trigger man? I am. But who's culpable for murder? The driver of the getaway car, because you facilitated the crime. Ladies and gentlemen, the United States policy on Iraq, the policy of regime removal, has facilitated the deaths of 1.5 to 1.5 million Iraqis. We are to blame. Every month for Saddam Hussein. And this is something that stains all of our conscience. It's a collective guilt for the people of the United States of America. I'm someone who won't accept the concept of good Germans and bad Germans prior to World War II. All of Germany is to blame for what happened during World War II. All of America is to blame for what's happening in Iraq today because we are a democracy. This is government of the people, by the people, for the people. It is our government's policy to do this to Iraq. Therefore, we are guilty. What are we going to do to terminate this policy? That's the question that faces us. But you can't talk about lifting sanctions until you talk about resolving the situation in regards to the disarmament of Iraq. And it is an unresolved situation. As a weapons inspector, I worked hard in Iraq from 1991 to 1998 with hundreds of my fellow colleagues to go in and oversee the disarmament of Iraq. And as I told you, it wasn't a perfect situation. The Iraqis were not fully cooperating. The governments of the Security Council were not willing to enforce their law. And yet, despite all of this, we had tremendous successes. By 1996, we were able to determine that 90 to 95% of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction capability was accounted for, including 100% of the factories used by Iraq to produce weapons of mass destruction, together with the majority of the production equipment associated with these factories. Furthermore, we were able to mitigate this uncertainty about the remaining 5 to 10% that's unaccounted for by noting that from 1994 to 1998, we monitored the totality of Iraq's industrial infrastructure, that which could be used by Iraq to produce weapons of mass destruction. We call it dual-use capabilities, a factory that can produce legitimate material, but if converted, could produce prohibited. We monitored this from 1994 to 1998 and never once found any evidence of retained prohibited capability or efforts by Iraq to reconstitute. So inspections were fairly successful, but they didn't achieve that 100%. They didn't achieve that 100%. Now, how did we get to the level that we did get? And some people might be fair to ask, 100% of what? I mean, if Iraq lied to you, if they submitted false declarations, how do you know you got 100%? 90 to 95% of what? What's your baseline? Well, you know, we learned a long time ago not to trust what the Iraqis told us. They lied to us too many times. They don't get the benefit of the doubt anymore. But I learned to also trust the hard work of my inspectors. We interrogated the Iraqis. We carried out good inspections, intrusive inspections. We took the work outside of Iraq. We went to Europe, to the countries that sold Iraq this materiel. We investigated trips made by Iraqi scientists. We got the immigration records, found out what days they visited a certain country, found out what hotels they stayed in, traced their phone calls to German companies or French companies, and then went to those companies and demanded access to the records so that we were able to ascertain what Iraq had procured. So when we went to an Iraqi scientist and said, how many machine tools of a certain type did you buy? And he said, two, only two. I swear it was like yesterday, only two. We can now confront him with a document that showed he, in fact, bought 15. And his signature at the bottom showed he had received it. And suddenly the Iraqi scientist had a great memory. And he said, yes, 15, 15, of course. And he would take us to the other 13 that were missing. That's how we disarmed Iraq, not by believing what the Iraqi said, but by the hard work of the weapons inspectors. There's a lot of concern out there about VX nerve agent today. People talk about it. It's unaccounted for. Yes, it's unaccounted for. You know, one reason why we have such concerns is the Iraqis lied about it for so long. They said, we don't have any VX nerve agent. So we inspectors, believing they did, would always investigate. We had intelligence that they produced it at one facility at this factory called Mufana State Establishment. We had this Dutch inspector, Case Walterbeek, a very good inspector, who would often go to this Mufana State Establishment and look wistfully at the building, where we had information that VX had been produced, but it had been stripped clean by the Iraqis, there was nothing left. He would look at the building and then move on. And he'd do this week after week, and finally the Iraqis came up to him and said, Mr. Walter, why are you looking at this building? He turned to him in frustration and said, because I believe that's where you had your VX nerve agent program. And the Iraqi, oh no, Mr. Walter Beck, we never had a VX nerve agent program there. We had it over here. And he pointed to a building that had been bombed during Desert Storm, hit with a 2,000-pound bomb, collapsing the roof on top of it, and a flash goes through Case's mind. You know, inside that building is a snapshot of what Iraq's capabilities were at the time of the bombing. That collapsed building means whatever documents are there, whatever material there is still there. So Case became a forensic archaeologist, sending a team in, lifting the roof up, crawling in, and gathering the documents. And it proved that Iraq had a basic research and development pilot plant for VX nerve agent. And we went to the Iraqis and said, why didn't you declare this? And they said, well, the declaration, you know, said, it was dated April, it said, declare our holdings of weapons of mass destruction. You blew up the building. We didn't have that capability anymore, so we just didn't declare it. And they sort of had a point. Except that when we went through the documents, we asked the Iraqis, how much VX did you produce? And they said, just, you know, small amounts, 30 liters, 50 liters. And suddenly the documents were finding out that they produced 3 tons, 4 tons. We said, hey, you're lying here. Some of the Iraqis had to admit that it was more than just a research and development facility. It was a pilot production plant. But I said, don't worry about it. It's all destroyed. But we said, okay, but we have to account for all the material. Where did you dispose of the material? They took us to a field. And they said, this is where we buried it, the precursors, the VX. It's all buried in here. And we did soil samples. We found that, yes, much had been destroyed, but we couldn't guarantee all of it. We said, how did you bring it here? And the Iraqis said, well, we brought it here in these steel vats, but what are you worried about? It's VX. It's not stable. I mean, the stuff's useless. Within days, it deteriorates. This is all much ado about nothing. They said, well, just show us the vats. So we went to the vats, and sure enough, they'd been cleaned out, swept clean with Clorox, no evidence, except at the end, there's this little purge valve. And one of our inspectors stuck a swab up the valve. There was liquid, put the liquid in a plastic bag, took it to the lab, stabilized VX. The Iraqis had lied to us again. So now we confront them. You stabilized VX. Yeah, we did, but you know, we never put it in a weapon, they said. Never put it in a weapon. So it wasn't weaponized. So we went to the weapons destruction pit, looked at where they had destroyed the weapon, we grabbed the shards, scraped off residue, took it to a lab, and we found the degradation byproduct of weaponized VX. I said, well, yeah, but there's nothing here. I mean, we never built a factory out of it. In fact, in 1997, we found 200 crates of material that were being hidden by the Iraqis that would have been used for a VX nerve agent factory. We found it, and we destroyed it. So let me ask you, where do we stand on VX nerve agent? Does Iraq have it, or don't they have it? When you look at the accumulation of facts, they had a production plant, pilot production. It's eliminated. They had material. We went to a field. It's eliminated. They say they stabilized it, put it in warheads, but the warheads are eliminated. They say they never had a large-scale manufacturing capability. Well, we eliminated that production equipment. So where do we stand with VX? I don't know the answer. And that's the problem with when we talk about disarming Iraq. Not all the gaps have been filled. Iraq cooperated to a great degree. We achieved a tremendous amount of verified disarmament, 90-95%. But we can't close all the gaps. And from the standpoint of the United States of America, that's a good thing. You see, because so long as Iraq isn't found to be disarmed, you can justify the continuation of economic sanctions containing Saddam Hussein, ensuring that, you know, he cannot break free and will ultimately find a way to get rid of him. And how do we get rid of him? CIA coups. From 1993 to 1998, we tried CIA coups no less than 5 times. They all failed. Why? Saddam Hussein has one of the most brutally efficient security apparatuses the world's ever seen. So now we come to 1998, weapons inspectors doing their job. We have 90-95% disarmament. There's not much left for us to find. We're going around Iraq saying we think we can account for everything. We can't find any evidence of Iraq having retained this stuff. There's, you know, gaps that we have there, but maybe it's time we talk about terminating this job. The United States says, no, you have to get 100%. So the only way to get 100% is to go after that missing 5 to 10%, which requires documentary evidence, which means we have to go looking for documents where? In the palaces, in the security installations. And the Iraqis are afraid of this. Why? Because the United States has a policy of regime removal. So you have yours truly leading inspection teams in the most sensitive areas of Iraq, gaining access to documents, gaining access to information, which upon assessment has nothing to do with disarmament, but when turned over to the United States, has everything to do with empowering the United States to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And that's what the United States was focused on doing, getting rid of Saddam Hussein. You ask yourself why inspectors left in 1998. Well, let me tell you, they were not kicked out by Saddam Hussein. That's mythology. They were ordered out by the United States government. They were ordered out after the United States government used the weapons inspection process to facilitate a crisis, a confrontation that then resulted in the United States ordering the inspectors out of the country, and then using the removal of inspectors as an excuse to begin bombing, a bombing campaign that was empowered by intelligence information gathered by the inspectors of 97 sites bombed in Operation Desert Fox, 86 dealt with Saddam Hussein's security, all of which were derived from intelligence information gathered by inspectors. The United States failed to get rid of Saddam Hussein, but what they did do is kill the inspectors, because having been exposed as nothing more than a front for American intelligence collection, the Iraqis weren't about to let the inspectors back in. And that's the situation we faced from 1998 until just recently, November of 2002, when inspectors went back. And now we have inspectors back. You know, prior to inspectors returning, it was possible for people to make a case for war against Iraq by citing Iraq's noncompliance and by citing the fact that Iraq refused to allow inspectors back in. But today, that case simply can't be made. As I said, we did a pretty darn good job from 1991 to 1998. We fundamentally disarmed Iraq. Now people say, well, Iraq could have done a lot of things from 1998 to 2002. Indeed, they could have, but you know, inspectors are there right now. Every single site cited by the CIA and the U.S. government in the fall of 2002 as being evidence of Iraq's continued work in weapons of mass destruction. You remember the briefings, Donald Rumsfeld and other up before you on American TV, showing you the photographs of factories that Iraq was rebuilding. Every site has been inspected by inspectors to date, and no site has been found to be doing anything of a prohibited nature. The Iraqis today are fulfilling their obligation to fully cooperate with the weapons inspectors. Everywhere the inspectors want to go, the Iraqis are facilitating their work. The Security Council has made it clear that if Iraq doesn't cooperate, it will enforce its laws severely, thereby meeting the second requirement of a successful inspection. And yet we're still confronted with that third polluting factor, the American policy of regime removal, getting rid of Saddam Hussein, which means that Iraq and the international community have to be concerned about what the motives are for the United States in providing intelligence to the weapons inspectors. Is it truly to facilitate disarmament, or is it about gaining access to information that will facilitate regime removal? And given the fact the United States has a stated policy of regime removal, we have to be concerned. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll tell you this. The way to stop a war in Iraq is to support the continued work of weapons inspectors inside Iraq. For so long as inspectors are at work in Iraq and getting the cooperation of the Iraqi government, there is no justification for war against Iraq. We must support the work of the inspectors. Furthermore, however, we must ensure that the policies of the United States of America conform with international law, meaning that if Iraq is found to be disarmed, then the game is up. You know, it's a simple equation, quid pro quo. Iraq is disarmed, sanctions are lifted, Iraq comes back into the fold of the international community with Saddam Hussein still at the helm, which, of course, is the last thing the Bush administration wants with its policy of regime removal, which tells you the Bush administration is dead set against disarming Iraq through the means of weapons inspections. No, the Bush administration's vision of disarming Iraq is through military intervention, an invasion, which tells you that this is not about weapons of mass destruction. You see, if the United States wanted to get rid of weapons of mass destruction, we have weapons inspectors who can do that. So what is this about? What is this regime removal truly about? And I'll tell you right now, it's about imperial power, imperialism. And it's something that we as Americans better start thinking about very carefully. In addition to reading the Constitution of the United States, the Gettysburg Address, and the United Nations Charter, among documents I would recommend, I also recommend that every American familiarize themselves with the National Security Strategy document the Bush administration promulgated in September of last year. This is a document that defines how we, the people of the United States of America, through our government, will interact with the international community. It states that the United States will take advantage of its overwhelming military and economic strength to impose a unilateral American solution on problems unilaterally defined by the United States of America. It says that we will operate outside the boundary of international law, that we alone will determine what constitutes justification for intervention, that we will preemptively intervene when required to defend the United States of America. It doesn't matter what the Security Council says. It's a rejection of multilateralism. It's a rejection of international law. It's an embracing of unilateral, imperial American power, plain and simple. And I have to tell you, as somebody who took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America, I am deeply affronted by this policy. As somebody who studied American history and understands that 220-some-odd years ago, our founding fathers fought a revolutionary war to free ourselves from imperial power, I find it abhorrent that today our nation is on the path of becoming that which we rejected. So when we speak of opposing war with Iraq, we speak of more than simply opposing war. That's a good enough thing to be in opposition of. We speak of more than defending the lives of innocent Iraqis who will perish in this war. We speak of more than standing up for the lives of those thousands of American soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who will perish in this war. Ladies and gentlemen, we speak about the fundamental definition of who we, the people of the United States, will be for decades to come. This is a critical moment in our nation's history. We are facing one of those truly defining moments. How the United States proceeds in the weeks and months to come in regards to Iraq will determine how the world views and interacts with the United States for decades to come. It is imperative that we oppose a war with Iraq and, you know, without just cause, unless there is a smoking gun, unless Iraq emerges as a grave threat. It is our duty and responsibility as law-abiding, freedom-loving Americans to stand up and say no to war with Iraq, because war with Iraq will destroy the very country we claim to embrace. If we go to war with Iraq, we will cease being the republic that was founded by our founding fathers 220 years ago. We will become instead an imperial power deserving of the enmity and hatred of the international community. We will become the largest lawbreaker the international community has seen. We will reject international law. We will be vilified. We will be opposed. It will mean the end of America. You know, what happens to all imperial powers? They die of indigestion. You go out there and you consume the world, and then that kills you. I don't want America to perish. Now, perishing doesn't necessarily mean that we will cease to exist as a body of land populated by people who call themselves Americans. No. We can call ourselves Americans, we can fly the American flag, but unless we stand up and defend the values that define us as Americans, we will cease being Americans. And I'll tell you this too, we're at war against terror right now. We haven't won that war yet. There are still forces out there who desire to do harm against America. And if we go to war against Iraq without support of the international community, without support of international law, we will be the number one recruiting poster for Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and the forces of anti-American Islamic fundamentalism. We will lose the war on terror. And losing the war on terror doesn't mean that Osama bin Laden will fly the flag of al-Qaeda over the White House. Losing the war on terror means that when I get up in the morning and put my kids on a school bus, and that school bus goes down the road, it vaporizes in an explosion because of a terrorist bomb. Losing the war on terror means that when I go to a shopping mall, have lunch with my family, we die, our lives are terminated because of a terrorist bomb. Losing the war on terror means that the freedoms that we enjoy as Americans will be placed under daily attack by those who feel oppressed by our policies. Ladies and gentlemen, let's not let that happen. Let's stand up. Let's assert our control of the United States of America. We, the people of the United States. It's government of the people, by the people, for the people. Let's take these words and turn them into action. Thank you very much.
Okay, I would like to thank you for your presentation, but throughout your presentation you didn't talk about oil, and that bothers me a lot. Thank you.
Okay, I think the question is, where does oil fit into this overall situation? I have to tell you that oil is very much a factor, but it's not the factor. When we speak of, you know, power and what drives, and let's be honest, what lights the buildings here? What powers America? What fuels America? What fuels our economy? What fuels the international economy? It's oil. So oil's always there. But when we talk about Iraq, I find it hard to, and again, I'll just say right up front, I'm a simple Marine, simple weapons inspector, and I don't claim to have, you know, wonderful insights into, you know, these complicated topics. So I'm just giving you my opinion. You can take it as you may. But, you know, if I were an oil man, it would be about making money. I mean, that's when you talk about oil, you talk about power, the power that comes with, you know, money. So when you speak of Iraq, a nation that right now has this, sitting on top of the world's second largest proven reserves of oil, they produce 1.5 million barrels of oil a day. When the oil minister of Iraq says, hey, if you lift economic sanctions, I'm willing to, you know, over a five-year period of time, take in a $50 billion investment and enlarge our daily oil production to about 6 to 7 million barrels a day and guarantee America and Europe's strategic supply of oil. So now if I'm an oil businessman, I go, wait a minute, I can go into Iraq, I can invest $50 billion over 5 years, and I can, you know, triple the amount of oil produced, quadruple, you know, man, that's great. I'm going to make a lot of money. So if we rub out oil, I think actually we'd be talking about lifting the sanctions. This is about something more than oil. This is about political power. This is about, in my personal opinion, the neoconservative wing of the Republican Party, which has basically hijacked the national security decision-making hierarchy of the government of the United States in the aftermath of the 2000 election, wanting to preserve their hold on power by promulgating the concept of fear, by taking exploiting the politics of fear and ignorance here among the American people, especially since September 11th. You know, we need a threat. We have to constantly feel that we are at risk. And Iraq plays that role. Saddam Hussein plays that role. And I believe our war in Iraq is not only about exploiting the fear and ignorance that exists about Iraq, but also implementing the first stage of this Bush doctrine of American unilateral intervention. But again, that's my opinion. I could be darn wrong. I think oil isn't leading this. Oil will definitely come in and exploit the situation, but I don't think oil is the leading reason for our war against Iraq.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Mr. Ritter, regarding your inspections, did you find weaponry that had been made in the United States, such as gyroscopes, and also I'd understood anthrax and botulism, were sent from the United States with Commerce Department approval? And did you travel to Basra, and did you see the evidence of use of depleted uranium, which is a war crime committed by the United States, to have used that and scattered it all over southern Iraq?
Okay. First of all, I'll condense your question down to, you know, did I find evidence of American involvement in Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs? Yes. The answer is yes, but let's put this in the balance and the perspective. I'm not trying to, you know, mitigate what the United States did. Of all the countries that provided Iraq with its weapons of mass destruction, understand that in no instance did anybody actually provide Iraq with a weapon of mass destruction. Iraq, and I don't like that term, weapon of mass destruction. I mean, really, the only weapon of mass destruction out there is a nuclear weapon in this category. A Marine Corps rifle company with an unlimited supply of ammunition is a weapon of mass destruction. A chemical weapon is a weapon of mass terror, a weapon of mass, it can kill people. But understand that, let's put, again, weapons of mass destruction in perspective. You know, from in the entire 21st or 20th century, 450,000 people were killed by weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, long-range ballistic missiles. And in the international community's effort to free Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, economic sanctions probably killed 1.5 million. So let's put it into perspective here. But again, the United Nations defines these weapons as prescribed. They say they must be done away with. In our investigation, we found that there were many companies and many countries out there that provided Iraq with the technical assistance required for them to produce these weapons. Western Europe, by far, was the greatest center in this regard. More than 50% of the companies involved with transferring technology to Iraq used for chemical, biological, and nuclear long-range ballistic missile manufacturing were provided by West German companies. French companies, British companies, Italian companies, Swiss companies, all are guilty. American companies, likewise, had some role in this. But the biggest role the United States played is twofold. One is funding. We provided agricultural loans totaling many billions of dollars, which the Iraqis received from us and then used, diverted, to help fund this acquisition of technology from Western Europe. And we knew about it, and we did nothing to stop it. I also find it somewhat hypocritical now that when we speak of, you know, holding Iraq accountable for using chemical weapons against the Iranians in 1988, I have spoken with Wafiq Samurai, the Iraqi general who headed up the Iraqi intelligence, military intelligence division responsible for Iran. Wafiq Samurai was the number one interactor between the United States in regards to the sharing of intelligence information. When the United States sits there in 1988, spread satellite maps before the Iraqis, show them where the Iranian military disposition is on the Afal Peninsula, and then sit back and say nothing when the Iraqi military planners come in and describe how they're going to employ chemical weapons, who has guilt? So, did the United States supply Iraq with weapons of mass destruction? Not directly, but definitely indirectly through funding and through acquiescence of policy. We knew what they were doing in the 1980s, and we did nothing to stop it. We knew they were developing chemical weapons. We knew where they were developing biological weapons. We knew they were using chemical weapons against their own people and against the Iranians, and we did nothing to stop it. And that's where I think the burden of the guilt lies, not so much that we provided them with the weapons, but we facilitated them acquiring these weapons. Now, you spoke of depleted uranium. You know, if you'll notice in the categories that we talked about, that's not mentioned. It's not a prescribed weapon. But I'll just tell you this as a military man. You know, when I go to war and I have my Marines with me and the enemy has T-72 tanks with armor, with reactive armor plating that defeats almost anything I have, my job is to kill the enemy and bring my Marines home alive. And I'm not apologetic about it. So I will bring to bear whatever weapon necessary to terminate the life of my enemy. Depleted uranium is a very effective tank killer. I can bring it in through air-powered munitions. I can bring it in through direct action munitions, tank round artillery rounds. And I will terminate the life of all those who oppose me. I'm not apologetic about it. The problem comes when you know that the weapon you use has this detrimental effect. When we know that if we employ a depleted uranium round, that we will contaminate the environment. Not only for Iraqi civilians, but for Americans. We have Americans today living with the scourge of depleted uranium in their body. American heroes, the people who wear our uniform in defense of our way of life, who have gone out there and in through the course of putting their life on the line, have been contaminated. And it's not just been there contaminated, but if you're a male and you're exposed to depleted uranium, you know, it resides in your testicles. And when you impregnate your wife, the child that comes out is oftentimes mutated. That's what depleted uranium does, not only to Americans, but to the Iraqis by the tens of thousands. Depleted uranium is a poison, and we know it today. Therefore, if we're going to continue to use it on the field of battle, we have a moral obligation that when that battle is done, we go in and we clean up the battlefield, and we do what is necessary to mitigate the impact that depleted uranium has on the environment. Because not to do so, I agree with you, is a crime.
If you wait for a second, please, due to time constraints and probably your answers as well, if I could take five people at a time, they would ask the questions and they may challenge your memory, or you could write a note there about it, and you could answer five at the same time, because I'd like to have all of your questions answered. And this is the reason I'm doing it. So, five at a time, please. Go ahead.
And I've been duly chastised. Okay, I'll keep it short, sir.
Thank you. My question is this. You have information that obviously members of Congress have as well. And my question is, why do you think the majority of Congress acquiesced and agreed to give up their rights to declare war and gave it to the president, number one. Number two, if the Iraqis are so paranoid and so intent on building a war machine, who are they going to hit, hypothetically? Certainly not us. We're the largest in the world. I'd like to get your comments on both of those. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Yes, without condescending to what happened at the World Trade Center and the military building, but yet these were apparently symbolisms of our capitalism and our military prowess. How do you react to that? That we were the first nation to use nuclear weapons on other people. Thank you.
Next question, please.
Yes, with the possible exception of Kuwait, most of Iraq's neighbors have much more fear in Israel's armament, nuclear, biological, and chemical, than they do of Iraq. And with Israel now asking us for $13 billion additional this year, and the fact they're violating international law through the occupation of Palestine, I'd like you to just comment, if you could, on what their arsenal is. It never gets in our papers, and if you know, I'd like some information. Thank you.
Next question, please.
Yes, I believe if I heard you correctly, Mr. Ritter, that you said that Saddam Hussein did not kick out our weapons inspectors, but that the weapons inspectors became confrontational. Can you tell me what kind of confrontational actions they took? Thank you.
Okay, and that's five. So
this is the last one.
Last one, okay.
On the UNET, the Unity Network, information we've been getting by computer, someone has suggested weapons of mass salvation. And that is that if we would take a portion of what we're planning on spending for this war and bomb them with supplies to build streets, with supplies to build hospitals, with supplies to build water and sanitation, and to rebuild the infrastructure, could we not then win this war?
Okay.
Thank you.
Why did the majority of Congress acquiesce? I believe they did so, as I mentioned at the beginning, because they were intimidated. I mean, just take a look at the election. Those who spoke out against the war were accused of being soft on Saddam. The Republican Party oftentimes ran ads that showed, you know, Saddam Hussein's face, Osama bin Laden's face, in the face of the individual who voted against the war. There are people who are fearful. It's part of the politics of fear and intimidation. And it's sad because many times you know, when people called in and you know, talked about the war with their representative, there were calls of 500 to 1, 1,000 to 1 against the war, and yet representatives did not heed the will of the people and voted for the war. Many congressmen and senators say that they did this because there was really a vote for peace, that by giving the power of war to the president, he backed up the Security Council's ability to enforce law and also you know, create an environment where Iraq would accept inspectors back. Okay, I disagree with that, but now that that happened, we have inspectors back in. So the question now is, why are the members of Congress acquiescing to the president's call for war when all of the requirements they thought were needed to be met when they voted for war have now been met? They have a resolution. There is a will to enforce, and inspectors are back getting the full cooperation. Why aren't members of Congress speaking out? And again, I think it's because of fear and intimidation. Who will Iraq hit? Right now, Iraq doesn't have the ability to hit anybody outside of its own borders. That's one of the big fallacies of this whole concept of the Iraqi threat. Iraq truly is a defanged tiger. Its conventional military has been devastated. And as long as weapons inspectors are in Iraq doing their job, there's no way Iraq can have a viable weapons of mass destruction program. So I don't think Iraq will hit. I think the threat that we have to talk about isn't who Iraq will hit, but rather if we invade Iraq, who the terrorists will hit, and that will come down on the heads of two nations, primarily the United States and Israel. And for anybody who out there, like me, is a friend of Israel, war with Iraq is the last thing you want, because a war with Iraq will terrorize Israel. We'll get to the question about Israel right now. Israel. When I spent 4 years working with Israel from 1994 to 1998. I headed up the United Nations intelligence sharing with the Israeli government in regards to the disarming of Iraq. When I went there in 1994, Israel, their strategic assessment said that Iraq was the number one threat to Israel's security. When I left in 1998, the assessment was that Iraq was number six and falling. The reason is the Israelis knew how good the inspectors had been in disarming Iraq. The Israelis knew that Iraq was no longer a threat to the state of Israel. Israel knew that the weapons inspectors represented the best vehicle for achieving, you know, a reduction of the Iraqi threat. So I don't believe when you talk about the Israeli military, they're not the ones clamoring for war with Iraq. Israel suffers from the same thing we suffer, a political group that are exploiting the politics of fear and ignorance to generate support, and they need a war with Iraq to create an environment that distracts the Israelis from the status of their economy, from the fact that there is a failed peace plan, from the fact that Israel's policies are, you know, if you go point by point, sometimes more egregious in their failure to recognize international law than even Iraq's. So a war with Iraq would distract all of that. 9/11 and terror. I'll say about 9/11 is this. You know, I was saddened as everybody was on 9/11, but let's remember all that happened on 9/11 was that 19 hijackers took over four airplanes. That's all that happened. We weren't attacked. It was a massive crime committed against us. Hijacking is a crime. Murder is a crime. And yet we responded as though it was a war, and we went to war against what? A nebulous enemy whom we still haven't brought to bear. You know, it was symbolic, yes, symbolic to go against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And it's symbolic because I think one of the things that we haven't asked in responding to 9/11 is why they attacked us. I think that's a question we all have to ask. Now, it's been said unpatriotic to ask that question. But I have to tell you, somebody who's hung around with a lot of counter-terrorist types, you know, yeah, big macho guys who go around, kick down the door, and put three-round center mass into bad guys and kill them. They know what the answer is. It's not running around the world terminating the life of individual terrorists. To win the war on terror, you have to determine at what point they become terrorists. You know, you're not born in this world being a terrorist. At some point, you transition into being somebody who has concerns, which are going to be dealt with through the rule of law, and somebody who has concerns, which are going to be dealt with through the tool of terror. Why do they become terrorists? If you answer that question and can isolate that, then you can prevent terrorists, and that's the only way you're going to win the war on terror, is to prevent terrorists from becoming terrorists. You can't go out and kill them all. And that brings into the question of, you know, bombarding them with money and bombarding them with goods. To win the war on terror, we're going to have to understand that in many cases, terrorist acts are carried out because people fear the United States, because people don't have hope for a better future, because we've denied them the ability to project themselves in the kind of lifestyle that we enjoy. They don't have the means to retaliate. You know, we have a policy of unilateralism that says when we view somebody as a threat, we will preemptively strike. Well, I guarantee you right now in the world today, there are many people who view the United States as a threat to their existence. They don't have F-16 fighter bombers. They don't have aircraft carriers or tanks. They got destitute young people who, because they have no hope, are willing to strap high explosives to their chest and go off and kill themselves. So the way to stop terror isn't to spend $1.3 trillion going to war against Iraq, but take a tenth of that, turn it over to the State Department, and have effective foreign aid that raises the standard of living, that empowers people to live a free and democratic life.
Now I have 15 minutes to take 10 people. So five and five, please.
Mr. Ritter, we're in a fix right at the moment, and Hans Blix and his team might discover something over in Iraq. If they do, give us some suggestions. You mentioned a phrase, diplomatic engagement. Speak to us so that we can go back to our friends and family and have something to say regarding that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ritter. My question is regarding the double-faced, double-standard policy of the United States of America when dealing with the crisis in Iraq compared to the crisis in Israel. We know that Israel has the atomic bomb. They have weapon of mass destruction. So does North Korea. But the United States is handling the situation differently. And because of the influence they have in the United Nations Security Council, I believe the United States can go and pick up any country in the world, and they can make an enemy of the world right now. We can choose Mexico, Brazil, and anything because of the influence of the United States of America on the United Nations Security Council. Thank you.
Some of us feel that our concerns have not been addressed since Bush was appointed president. When you make the excellent suggestion to stop this action by engaging in our American civil duties, I do not feel faith anymore that my action will result in anything. I'd like you to speak to that issue for all of us who feel that way and what we can do.
We often hear that the burden is on Iraq to prove that it does not have the prohibited weapons. Is there any way Iraq could actually prove that?
From your experience in Iraq, and especially with the Iraqi government, if you can explain, regarding the Iraqi mentality and the way the regime is set, do you think when the invasion, and I underline, when the invasion takes place, do you think they will run like they did in Kuwait, or will they resist, and would you blame them for resisting? Thank you.
Okay, these are fine. Thank you.
Okay, these are all tremendously good questions. And again, I'll just right off the start note that I truly am a simple Marine with weapons inspection experience, and some of these questions, as Joe Biden pointed out a couple years ago, are way above my pay grade, but I'll do my best to answer them. If they do find weapons of mass destruction, I mean, here's where perhaps the underlying philosophies of myself and others in this room might differ, because I believe, I think it's a fair statement to say most people in this room just reject violence as a means of resolving disputes, and while I endorse that, I'm also someone who believes that if a threat emerges to the United States of America, it has to be dealt with, and sometimes that means militarily. If they find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq today, more than 10 years after the international community has banned these weapons, I think we have every right to presume ill intent on the part of Iraq. Why would they have these weapons today? And it goes well beyond the analysis, therefore, that one could make that these weapons in and of themselves do not constitute a threat. I mean, look at North Korea. North Korea has nuclear weapons. They've rejected weapons inspectors. They're flying in the face of international law, and yet we're going to deal with North Korea diplomatically. And one could say that we should hold that same standard to Iraq, that Iraq is a problem that can be dealt with diplomatically. But given the rhetoric and given the history of Iraq, I'm afraid that if Iraq is found to have viable weapons of mass destruction programs, because of the war on terror, because of the fear factor that exists with weapons of mass destruction, there's not going to be anything you can do to stop a war. The best thing you could do is to ensure that if there is a war fought against Iraq, it's done within the framework of international law with the full support of a Security Council resolution, and that America builds as large and viable a coalition as possible so that we are not standing alone. And then to limit that war with Iraq to Iraq and not let it turn into a springboard for, you know, ongoing imperial hegemony. But that's not what you want. You want to know how to stop the war to begin with. And I'd just say it's an uphill battle, but maybe one tool would be to use the North Korean model and to say, look, diplomacy at the end of the day, you know, might mitigate the threat posed without causing American lives and indeed Iraqi lives to be sacrificed. Israel and weapons of mass destruction. There's no doubt there's a double standard here. I mean, there's no doubt. Israel is one of the largest violators of international law in regards to weapons of mass destruction, and nuclear weapons are a violation. What I would say is this: you cannot talk about application of the rule of law unless you're willing to apply it uniformly across the board. When you speak of Iraq's obligation to disarm, understand that disarmament doesn't take place in a vacuum. Why did Iraq choose to acquire these weapons to begin with? What were they used for? Understand that Iraq is surrounded by nations that possess similar capability. That if we're going to talk about getting rid of weapons of mass destruction, it cannot be done in isolation, simply focusing on Iraq. We have to talk about, in the Middle East, a region free of weapons of mass destruction, which means Israel will have to be disarmed at some point. Because as long as Israel has a nuclear weapon, its neighbors will seek to acquire a nuclear weapon. But let's take it a step further. You know, how do we get rid of nuclear weapons? That seems to be one of our biggest policy objectives. But why do people have nuclear weapons? I mean, heck, we were the first ones to get them. America got nuclear weapons, so the Russians, the Soviets said, we need nuclear weapons, so they got them. Then the Chinese said, well, we need them because the Russians got them. Then the Indians said, well, we need them because the Chinese got them. The Pakistanis said, we need them because the Indians got them. And Israel has them, so everybody wants them. So the only way truly to get rid of weapons of mass destruction is to bring the world's arsenal down to zero, and that includes the United States of America.
And you say that the concerns haven't been addressed, and I agree. Right now, Congress appears to be deaf. But let me ask you this. When you go to the elections on Election Day, how many of you really pick the slate of candidates that appears before you? I mean, when you go on a primary, did you pick the people that are there before, or did someone else pick them? I mean, are you just sort of being faced with a fait accompli? You know, here are your list of candidates. Check them. Are those truly the four most qualified people to represent you in your district? No. For democracy to work, you've got to seize control of democratic institutions, which means that starting right now, when we speak of the 2004 election, you better be determining who represents you. That way, you know they will respond to you. If you continue to allow corporate elites and power to buy the candidates, to pick the candidates for you, you're going to continue to run into a situation where they don't pay attention to you. What can you do now, though? Again, I would recommend that if you want your candidates to pay attention to you, go to the county courthouse and find out who funded their election. Get the top 10 list of money providers to that candidate, and then go to them and hold them accountable. If they're businessmen, boycott their businesses until they sign a petition that puts pressure on the elected representative to adhere to the will of the people, because that is what a democracy is about, the will of the people. Burden on Iraq. The Bush administration says the burden is on Iraq to prove it's innocent. And in some ways, there is legitimacy to that, given the fact that Iraq has lied and concealed and distorted the truth. But if you're somebody who believes in the rule of law, you have to understand that at the end of the day, you are innocent until proven guilty. I believe the burden is on Iraq to do everything they can to win back the trust and faith of the international community in regards to weapons of mass destruction. That's why I'm very upset about what happened last week with the finding of these 12 artillery rockets. It doesn't mean that Iraq has a weapons of mass destruction program, but it does mean that Iraq's not doing everything it can do to facilitate the work of the inspectors. Why do the inspectors have to find these weapons? Iraq says, oh, it slipped our mind. But why didn't Saddam Hussein order his officers into every bunker in Iraq to go through every box, to open the boxes, to make sure that Iraq proactively turns this stuff over? That would go a long way in facilitating trust and confidence. Why did the United Nations inspectors have to go find 3,000 pages of documents in the home of a nuclear physicist? If they had turned these pages over to begin with, that would go a long way. So I think that the burden is on Iraq to win back the trust and confidence in the international community, and we cannot talk about giving Iraq a clean bill of health until they do so. So that's where the burden is. But when it comes time to go to war, different standard altogether.
If we're going to go to war against Iraq because they pose a threat to the security of the United States of America and the international community, we need proof. You cannot convict Iraq for a crime that you cannot prove committed. If you can't prove that Iraq has a weapons of mass destruction program, if you can't prove that Iraq is concealing, then we can't talk about war. The burden of proof is on the international community to prove that Iraq has these weapons. Iraq has put forward a declaration listing the totality of everything. We have accounting problems with this declaration, but we have no proof that Iraq is lying. Therefore, we cannot talk about going to war with Iraq until we develop that proof. And if we invade Iraq, unfortunately, some people believe that it's when we invade Iraq, will Iraq run or fight? That's the big unknown. When I went to war against Iraq, we had 600,000 American service members involved to liberate Kuwait. Today we're talking about invading and occupying Iraq with a force of 250,000. It's a little scary because those numbers don't quite add up when Iraq has 400,000 people in their armed forces who will be defending their cities, their homes, their towns, their villages in an urban environment where you need 5 to 6 to 1 odds in favor of the attacker to achieve supremacy. It doesn't add up. But they say Iraq's going to run away, surrender. Fine. I don't think the Iraqi people are going to fight for Saddam Hussein. I don't think the Russians fought for Joe Stalin in June 1941. But when that German invader came over the border, they sure as hell fought. They fought for their homeland. They fought for their villages, for their towns. And they fought the German invader. And if the American invader goes into Iraq, the Iraqis will fight us. They'll fight us in the streets, the villages, the towns, not because they love Saddam Hussein, but because they love Iraq and because they'll defend Iraq. And they will be justified in defending Iraq, even though tragically that means that they will be slaughtered by the tens of thousands and many thousands of Americans will lose their life. That's why I don't believe we should be talking about war with Iraq, because war, as I said earlier on, is about one thing and one thing only, death and destruction. It's a failure of humanity, not a victory for humanity.
You touched on this a little bit earlier, and I hope it's not too off topic, but I'm interested to hear your thoughts on North Korea. And one of the things that I found the most frustrating over this whole fiasco is the inconsistency in the United States policy and the Bush administration's policy in relationship between our hardline policy on Iraq and our lax, hands-off policy with North Korea. Thank you.
You answered most of my question, but anyway, I want to see who is the next removal regime. Who is the next removal regime? I mean, who's George Bush going to remove next regime in the Middle East? Is it Saddam only going to stop there, or who's next? And also, who is the winner in this war? Thank you very much.
Mr. Ryder, I recently did some research about the Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. The good news I found is that it's very consistent. Of course, the bad news is it's on some very scary premise. But what I think really shocked me is that I think that if I had printed out the information I learned and passed it out to everyone here in this room, we could have figured out back in the 1980s that he probably wasn't a very good guy to do business with. My question is, hearing things that Ramsey Clark has said about, do you really think for 5 or 10 minutes that they're not planting 5 to 10 more of these kind of situations in 10 or 20 years out or in next year or whatever? How can we be proactive so that these situations that are very clearly setups, how can we be, as the American people, proactive to stop this before we get to this point?
You mentioned previously about how Saddam Hussein is not at fault for the thousands of Iraqi deaths that resulted from the economic sanctions. I don't see who else could be at fault, though, after he refused the oil for food program and used oil revenues to instead build up a nuclear and weapons of mass destruction program and denied food from his own people that consequently did result in thousands of Iraqi deaths.
Thank you, Mr. Ritter. You're a real, real patriot. If we could just comment on two things. First, the lack of any link between Saddam and 9/11 that's perpetuating, I think, this fear. A little bit also about is George trying to redeem his daddy, what happened in 1990. And one more thing is this also, can you comment on the cover-up of Bush's lack of economic problems in this country that he has not faced? Thank you.
Okay, North Korean inconsistency, I touched on that, but again, I think what it highlights is that this is not a national security issue when we talk about Iraq. I mean, North Korea clearly represents a greater threat to American interests than does Iraq at this point in time. The death and destruction that can be dealt out by the North Koreans in a moment's notice on South Korea and Japan it far outweighs anything that the Iraqi government can do at this point in time. In many ways, the North Korean diplomatic solution is going to be much more difficult than any diplomatic solution we could try and achieve with Iraq. Iraq is open to diplomatic engagement. I find it somewhat frustrating that when we talk about North Korea, you know, the Colin Powell has met with their foreign minister. They have delegations in talking with the United States. When we speak of Iraq, there's been zero diplomatic interaction between the United States and Iraq in the past decade. And it is this kind of inconsistency that starts to raise questions, not only at home, but also abroad. People are wondering what the true objectives are of the Bush administration in regards to Iraq. And it's not, you know, I mean, North Korea highlights that, but it's also, when you start taking a look at the justification the Bush administration uses, I'm going to jump to the last question, the link between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. I mean, you hear over and over again how, you know, we need to take out Iraq to win the war on terror. And yet there's been no evidence provided that Iraq is linked to 9/11, that there is a connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. In fact, if you study all the details of it, you'll find that not only are there no facts, but there's no logical reason for this. Saddam Hussein is a dictator, a secular dictator, who has declared war against Islamic fundamentalism for the past 30 years. When you talk about Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, Osama bin Laden has issued a fatwa, a religious edict. While many imams will say it has no bearing, many people believe it does. That Saddam Hussein is an apostate or defiler of Islam, thereby justifying his death. Osama bin Laden has issued a death warrant against Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein has done the same to Osama bin Laden, noting that anybody who proselytizes in the name of Wahhabism or the sect of Sunni Islam that is espoused by Osama bin Laden and his and al-Qaeda, anybody who's caught proselytizing in the name of Wahhabism inside Iraq is given the death penalty. So they're both sworn to kill each other. Why would Saddam Hussein facilitate Osama bin Laden's work? But sadly, the war of propaganda has gone the other way. In a recent poll, 80% of Americans believe that there's a link between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. And most of the Americans who make that statement say it's because, you know, we know that there was a meeting in Prague, Czechoslovakia between Mohammed Atta, one of the ringleaders of the September 11th attack, and an Iraqi official. Except now both the CIA, the FBI, and the Czech government say that meeting never took place. But that seems to escape the majority of Americans who go, that meeting took place, therefore we know there's a link. There has been no proven link. So, you know, what's the reason? Does Iraq pose a threat to us? Is it weapons of mass destruction? Or is it something larger? This is about George redeeming daddy. I would just say this in regards to that assassination. As Americans, we would never accept a confession extracted by torture. And when the FBI sat down and interrogated those people who were arrested by the Kuwaiti government on suspicion of this assassination attempt, every single one of them recanted their confession and said it was extracted by torture. So I'd be a little hesitant about saying that the Iraqi government tried to assassinate George Herbert Walker Bush when he was visiting Kuwait, because in the rule of law, that evidence which supports that would be thrown out because it was extracted by torture, and I would be loath to think the United States would give legitimacy to any confession that was extracted in that manner. Who's the winner in all of this? Well, clearly the winner is going to be the neoconservative wing of the Republican Party and the neoconservative wing of the Likud Party, who will continue to empower themselves by exploiting the politics of fear and ignorance by, you know, creating an environment of perpetual conflict in which the will of the people can be suppressed by telling them that if they don't do this, they're in danger, and anybody who dares speak out is unpatriotic. Because I believe that's what this war is about. It's about, it's a naked grab for political power. And you said the Ba'ath Party, you know, what can we do that's more proactive in regards to dealing with them? You know, there's no doubt that the nature of the Iraqi regime is horrific. Their human rights record is bad, their concept of democratization. And, you know, George W. Bush has opened up, vulnerability here. Our policy is regime removal. So I'm going to leave you with a final idea on how we can achieve regime removal without going to war, thereby averting war and promoting peace. Back in the fall of last year, the president was asked if war was inevitable, if regime, you know, what is the policy here? I mean, what happens if Iraq cooperates? And the president said, you know, if Iraq cooperates with the weapons inspectors, that will show that the nature of the regime has changed, that we have in fact achieved regime removal, even with Saddam Hussein being in power. Now we're told that it's more than just weapons of mass destruction, that we're also concerned about human rights, about democratization, that these are key issues too, supporting the war with Iraq. So that's why I'm leaving for Iraq on Monday, or on Tuesday. I'm going to go into Iraq with a delegation, and we're going to meet with the Iraqi government. And we're going to get the Iraqi government, hopefully, to announce sweeping new policies in regards to human rights, the creation of a special office under the president of Iraq for human rights, inviting the United Nations Special Rapporteur for Human Rights back to Iraq to oversee Iraq's human rights record, by announcing the potential for free and open elections in Iraq for parliament in 3 years. Now we've spoken of human rights and democratization. We've talked about regime change. And what I would say is if the Iraqi government agrees to measures such as this, we now have three things in place which represent regime change. Full Iraqi support of weapons inspections, continuing compliance, Iraq's willingness to open themselves up to international observation in regards to human rights, and Iraq's willingness to begin the implementation of the building of democratic institutions. This is regime change. This is proactive. This can prevent a war. The question is, if somebody's got the guts enough to go into Iraq and get the Iraqi government to agree to this, what are you going to do here at home to reinforce that concept? Because it's not just about the Iraqi government making these announcements and living up to these announcements. It's how it's followed through here in America, because war with Iraq will not be stopped in Baghdad. War with Iraq will not be stopped in the United Nations. War with Iraq will not be stopped anywhere but Washington, D.C. And in order to get Washington, D.C. to stop war with Iraq, the President of the United States has to be convinced that by going to war with Iraq, he will lose more politically than he will by not going to war with Iraq. So if the President can be given a faith-saving means of withdrawing from this, if it can be demonstrated that, in fact, because of the President's resolute stance, Iraq has changed its regime through non-military means, that would be a victory in the name of peace. Thank you very much.
On behalf of the Unity Network, the United Church of Christ, the Islamic Center of Clermont, and all other supporting organizations, I'd like to thank you very much for accepting our invitation and giving us this delightful speech. Ladies and gentlemen, I have another surprise to you, and I'd like to introduce Pat Flores to tell you about it. So if you could wait a little bit for us. Thank you.
I'll talk real fast. The Unity Network is led by three women.